Stephen Gross waited until he was 60 to publish his first book, The Examined Life. It was a huge overnight success, a bestseller here in Britain, and translated into more than 20 languages across the world. It's a distillation of the lifetime he has spent as a psychoanalyst, tens of thousands of hours listening to people in hospitals, forensic clinics, and in private practice. It reads like a collection of short stories, full of vignettes of memorable characters, the man who faked his own death, the pathological liar, the lovesick middle-aged woman who meets a man at a party and turns up at his house the next week with a removals van to move in with him. It's a book I found absolutely fascinating, Stephen, and I think that one of the reasons that it's been quite so successful is that it's about secrets, not just about the secrets people hide from those around them, but secrets they hide from themselves.
I think it is. It is about the secrets we keep from ourselves. Most of the stories begin with a riddle. There are things, some people have described them as little mysteries too. And that's often how it is with a patient. Someone comes in pain and they are suffering. They don't know why they're suffering. I don't know why they're suffering. And this is something that we have to solve together.
The subtitle of the book is How We Lose and Find Ourselves. And clearly, for many people, these sessions are cathartic. And that is something that people say about music. Mm-hmm. Do you think music can help with that process of discovery?
Absolutely. There's a point in Proust where the narrator says something like, music helped me to descend into myself, to discover new things. And I love that. I think it does. I sort of thought, Michael, when I'd come in today, that I was going to treat you like a psychoanalyst, that I took the private passions seriously, that these are my private passions and that you were going to make sense of them in some way. And you'll see a thread or something, which I'm not seeing. I also think music has deep connections to memory and our past. As I was preparing and thinking about my list of things to bring to you today, it's so interesting, things which how... I don't know, I read Anna Karenina when I was young, and I had thought that Anna and Vronsky were soulmates, and Anna's husband was this terrible killjoy. Now, of course, when I read the book, I don't think of her like that. And the same thing happens with music. There were things which I loved when I was young, which I don't really like that much now, and things which I didn't really appreciate when I was young, which now have come to mean much more to me.
Well, talking about when you were young, a good place to start with a psychoanalyst. this was, I think, probably the first record you ever bought.
It is. Well, I remember buying it very specifically. I think I probably before then convinced my mom or dad to buy records for me when I was growing up near Chicago. But there's that special feeling. And record stores were so important. In the 60s, I lived in record stores. I was always in and out of them.
You were a student at Berkeley, weren't you?
I was a student. I was an undergraduate there. And in fact, I hung around a record store so much that they eventually asked me if I wanted to work there. And I did work there for a number of years. And I remembered going into this store, hearing this for the first time, and just having to have it, and just being terribly moved by it. It just caught my ear. I remember feeling that thing which you can sometimes have when you hear someone playing the piano almost like it's breathing, the kind of way that the pianist and the piano are at one with together. It's Horowitz playing Scarlatti.
Thank you.
very tender, isn't it?
It's tender, but it's also very plaintive and yearning. It's that upward thing, ba-dee-da-dum, which keeps coming back and is sort of seeking upwards somehow. Yeah. Part of Scarlatti's Sonata in F minor, Kirkpatrick 466, played by Vladimir Horowitz. Now, do you still have that record, Stephen Grace?
I have it probably in LP, cassette, CD, and now on my iPod. So.
You have quite a collection, don't you?
I do have a lot of records, yeah.
I mean, difficulty in housing them?
It is. Most of them right now are under the staircase in the basement, and I kind of long to have a turntable out somewhere where we can get all of them out, a lot of them.
What you need is a massive jukebox so that you could actually just press a button and your favourite piece would come up. But you played the organ and the piano yourself in a band as a teenager.
I did. Growing up, I think my brother did. I think everyone I knew played in bands. The music was our medium. We lived in music. We listened to the radio. We all listened to the same station. We all knew the same songs. And there were certain things that I think, having a kind of ordinary American middle-class childhood, we listened to certain programs on television. There were these wonderful television programs of Leonard Bernstein's children's concerts on Sunday afternoons. What is a symphony? What is orchestration? What does music mean? Who was Mahler? And I loved those. Those were fantastic.
So Berkeley, California, I say Berkeley, but of course it's Berkeley, in the 60s, quite a radical place. You were brought up, as you said, near Chicago, and your parents were immigrants from Eastern Europe. And your father ran a grocery store.
Yes.
Your mother was a painter. So you were just mentioning Leonard Bernstein. And, yeah. And did your parents like listening to music themselves?
They did. I remember Live from the Met on Saturday afternoons, Texaco Live from the Met. I remember these concerts. Those programs that were on with Leonard Bernstein were something quite democratic. They were like the proms in a way, but they were very educational. I remember him saying, children, do you know what a cadenza is? And I'll show you what a cadenza. And he would show you what a cadenza, and the first violinist would hop up and they'd play. And they were wonderful. I also learned things. I remember there was one program, something like Fidelio, a flawed masterpiece. And the idea that something could be a masterpiece and have things wrong in it. And he explained the things that he thought were wrong, but he also explained why he thought it was just amazing. And that was a wonderful thing. So,
I think it was listening to the radio on a Sunday afternoon that brought you to this next piece.
Yes. I mean, this is a piece which I was reminded of, but it's one of those things. I think probably I might have even heard it on the Leonard Bernstein program. It's a private passion in the sense that if I'm out walking, I might find myself humming the melody of this movement. My wife might catch me humming this to myself. I just think of a very beautiful soaring melody. people don't choose Brahms symphonies often, do they, Michael?
No, I've never quite understood it, because I think, apart from anything else, the openings of the Brahms symphonies are some of the greatest openings in music. Again, that lilting quality. Interesting there that that upward movement was not unlike the Scarlatti, was right. it?
Yes, and you feel the yearning and the longing in it.
The third movement of Brahms's Third Symphony, Claudio Abbado conducting the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra. And we're going to move on to a very different music now, something which is just extremely funny, I think, just for a change.
Yes, it is. And I think one of the things I wanted to do in my selection was music makes me laugh, and it does give me pleasure. And it was important somehow to bring that in. There are things, you know, Gilbert and Sullivan or Tom Lehrer, or in our family, one of the favorites is Jimmy Durante. There are these songs. There's one that we love playing. I'll never forget the day I read a book, a song of his, which is very funny. This is a song which is by a serious blues jazz singer, Alberta Hunter. I don't really want to say much more. I think she should let the song speak for itself.
Should we just say that it's called My Handyman Ain't Handy No More?
That's right.
Now, whoever said a good man was hard to find, positively, absolutely sure was blind. 'Cause I've just found the best man that ever was, and here's just a few of the things that he does. Ow. He shakes my ashes, greases my griddle, churns my butter, and he strokes my fiddle. Oh, my man is such a handy man. Now he threads my needle and he creams my wheat, heats my heater, and he chops my meat. He's a mess. My man is such a handy man. Believe it or not, he's a mighty nice man to have around. 'Cause when my furnace gets too hot, he's right there to turn my damper down. For everything, that man of mine's got a scheme, and honey, it's amazing the way he handles my machine. My man is such a handy man. Oh, that man is a mess. Ow. He flaps my flapjacks, cleans off the table, feeds the horses in my stable. My man is such a handy man. And do you know, sometimes he's up way before dawn, busy cleaning the rough edges off my lawn. My man is such a handy man. Now he never has a single word to say while he's working hard, poor soul. And I'd give anything if you could see the way he handles my front yard. Ow. Now my ice never gets a chance to melt away, 'cause he sees that I get a nice fresh piece every day. My man is such a handy man.
Which of those double entendres is your favourite?
Flapping flapjacks, I think.
My handyman ain't handy no more. Alberta Hunter from her 1978 album Amtrak Blues. And amazingly, she was 83 when that album was cut. We've put all the details of today's recordings on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website if you'd like to investigate the lyrics of that song. A song unquestionably about sex. But actually, Stephen Grosser, some critics have pointed out, there's surprisingly little sex in your book, per se.
I think people may have that idea that that's what psychoanalysis is about. But actually, the truth is I write about what concerns my patients most. And I think what concerns them most probably is intimacy, loneliness, rejection, ultimately love.
And actually, your next book is going to be about love and intimacy, isn't it?
It is. If this first book was about the difficulty of change and how loss is involved in that, the next book I'm working on is about the obstacles, some of the obstacles that we put before ourselves in trying to reach love, a love that lasts during our life. Yeah.
There are quite a few challenging ideas in your book, The Examined Life, especially for people who have very conventional ideas about how, for example, to bring up children. Because you've got this idea which you lay bare in quite a fascinating way and convincing, I think, that we bring up children by praise to too great an extent, and therefore there comes a point that they can never quite live up to that praise.
Right. It's not just praise. It was a kind of particular kind of praise, empty praise. And I felt that in our generation, I don't know about you, Michael, but there was often thoughtless or criticism of children. You were often felt criticized or shamed. You should have done this. You should do this. Sit up. Don't do this. Don't do that. And I felt this generation was being endlessly told. And it arose from an instance of hearing my daughter praised about something and realizing that, of course, if a child's praised, there's no real motivation. For example, if you're praised about the drawing that you've done, to do a new drawing or do it in a new way. And what really struck me was I tried to ask myself, what does give children confidence? And I thought that this kind of empty praise was an expression of indifference. And really what children needed and what I'd always felt helped myself and others was the experience of someone being present with a work. I don't know if you feel this about your composition, where someone really listens, isn't praising particularly about it, but it's nice to get praise about the work that we do, but someone's really involved in it and thinks about it with you and says, oh, why did you do that? And why this? And what's going on here? That being present with another person, I think, is extremely difficult to do, to be present with a child really fully and to talk to them and get involved in what they're doing.
Well, that's fascinating for me to hear because my father, who's a composer, Lennox Berkeley, and when Ravel came to Oxford in the 20s, he took my father to Paris and said you should study with Nardian Boulanger, who really made him work for 2 or 3 years. He wasn't allowed to write a note of his own music. So when my mother said to my father when I was a young child, a teenager, will he ever be any good as a composer, Michael? Lennox said, and I was told this, he could be, but he'll have to do a hell of a lot more work.
Right.
And actually, that was accurate. That was based on his assessment of what I'd done, what he'd experienced. And I think it was good because it did mean that, I realized those things I needed to do.
Yes, I just agree with that. I think there's no shortcut. And sometimes it's a fantasy. We hope that there will be a shortcut or that our child will be a genius or somehow get around things.
But I think modern communication, modern television is an idea, this fame for 15 minutes,
yes.
The fact that you can whiz in a sort of talent show or something, that your life can be transported within an instant, actually rather takes away the work ethic, because any great artist will tell you, whether it's Hockney or whoever, that 3% inspiration, 97% perspiration.
Yes, I completely agree with that. And I think how to help our children to have a capacity for work, to enjoy work in a climate or culture where you feel you can instantly become a celebrity is hard. It is hard.
Your next music is another gospel song, but this time it's about death. And in fact, I suppose it's a sort of dialogue with death, isn't it?
It is. It's Bessie Jones. And it's her singing on her own, and it is a dialogue with death. She would have said, I think, it was a spiritual, it's a sinner begging death to spare him, to have mercy, and then they go back and forth, and death replies. I find the verses, as they were intended to be, quite frightening. There's one point where death says something, I'm going to fix your feet so you cannot walk, fix your tongue so you cannot talk, close your eyes so you cannot see, and you got to come and go with me. Whenever I hear the song, I get chills and things. Mm-hmm. But it is that dialogue that you said.
Oh, death in the morning. Oh, death in the morning. Oh, death in the morning. Spread me over and another year. Well, death walked up to the Santa's gate. To believe you have waited now a little too late. Your feet were not 102. Have a narrow chance if you ever put through. They cried, oh, death. Crying, oh, death in the morning. Oh, death. Despair me over in another year. Hey, what is this I see? Cold ice and hands all over me. He say I am deaf, no one can excel. I open the doors of death and hell. He cried, Lord, death. Now, oh, death in the morning, oh, death, just bear me over in another year. No, you heard God people sing and pray. You would not heed, you just walked away. You would not even bend your knee. Now you got to come and go with me. They cried, Lord, death. Now, death in the morning, oh, death, just spare me over another year. Well, I'm gonna fix your feet so you cannot walk. Fix your tongue where you cannot talk. Close your eyes and you cannot see. And you got to come and go with me. She cried, Lord, death. Now, oh, oh, death in the morning, oh, oh, death, death spread me over another year. Well, death, consider my age, and do not take me in this state, because all of my wealth is at your command. If you just remove your cold, icy hand, you cry, no, no. Now, oh, death in the morning, no, oh, no. Lord, spare me over in another year. Oh, mother standing by the bed with an aching heart and a hung down head. And the doctor looked around very sad. Says the worst old case I ever had. He cried, Lord, death. Now, oh, oh, death in the morning. Oh, oh, death. Death spread me over in another year. He said, mother, I got feet and I can't walk. I got a tongue, mother, I can't talk. I got eyes and I can't see. Nothing but death got the shackles on me. Now, Lord, death. Now, oh, death in the morning. Oh, oh, death. Death spared me over in another year.
Bessie Jones and Oh Death, another singer who lived into her 80s. In fact, I think when she was interviewed in the early 1980s, she said she hadn't been to a doctor since 1925. Another way, Stephen Gross, that you challenge current thinking is in what you have to say about death and grief, and that perhaps we've got things wrong.
There's a piece in my book on the idea of closure. Mm. And I think I wrote it sort of out of, I don't know, irritation or kind of anger at seeing some of my patients suffering twice, there were patients who were in grief, but then had the notion that they were doing something wrong because they hadn't gotten over it. A woman who had lost a child many years earlier, but still found herself having certain ideas that were irrational. And she said to me, shouldn't I be over this? Shouldn't I have closure on this? And a young man whose father had committed suicide and also said, I should have had closure on this thing years ago. And I felt that they were suffering twice. First, there was their mourning. There was their grief. And then there was what I call in the book a tyranny of shoulds. I should be over it. I should feel differently. I shouldn't be doing these things. And the idea of closure came from Kubler-Ross, and it seemed to me appropriate for people who are dying. They do come to an end, and there may be these stages. But as long as we live, we may feel grief at certain times. It may come up at anniversaries, and that grief was actually a living thing. And it seemed to me that closure might be related to the fantasy that we could do something and stop having a particular feeling that was painful for us, that we just needed to do something and everything would change. And I actually felt and feel from my work and from what I've learned with patients that often our feelings are, well, they're like the weather. They're just bigger than us and we don't control them. We have to adjust to them.
Mm-hmm. Schubert.
Yes.
Next. And since we're talking about death and grief, of course, a composer who died far too young.
Yes.
And we can't really help but remember that when I listen to his music quite often, because it's extraordinary. Well, like with Mozart, when one thinks that these composers wrote all this music by the time most of us had hardly lived half our lives.
Right. Part of the power of the music is knowing that about Schubert and feeling that this is also the music of someone who has just seen so much and experienced so much, but even at a young age is composing in this way.
And I think that some aspect of human fragility is conveyed, and which is why you like it, in Alfred Brendel's performance.
There's something about this performance, a kind of hesitancy, a restraint. It feels it's right from his heart to the heart of the listener. I feel it's so direct and powerful.
Thank you.
extraordinary visionary music. The slow movement of Schubert's Piano Sonata No. 20, played by Alfred Brendel. And we've been talking about loss, and I hear it in that piece, Stephen Gross, and I wonder if, therefore, I could ask you to read the epigraph from your book. It seems to me incredibly relevant, both to the book and to that piece of music, and it's by the American writer André Dubus.
We receive and we lose, and we must try to achieve gratitude, and with that gratitude, to embrace with whole hearts whatever of life that remains after the losses.
That sense of gratitude is very important to you, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it's one of those things which I feel my patients teach me about, or that I've learned with them. I think that the patients or the people that I've worked with who are most at peace in themselves, are happiest in themselves, are people who are alert to moments each day when they can feel grateful. They see things during the day which they give them pleasure, and they appreciate them. And the people who are going around feeling entitled or aggrieved tend to be quite unhappy. So it's, I think, a sort of habit of mind if you can do that, and also have habits in your life if you can try and live in a way to try and be grateful for the things that you have.
So we should perhaps be grateful rather than search for lost times, past times.
Part of the stories in the book are about sometimes the misery that people get into by being too much involved in the past or too much involved in the future. We can't change the past. If you're thinking about the past too much and going over it, you will get depressed because we're impotent to change the past and we're impotent to change the far future. We're much better off if we can stay focused on where we are now.
Another reminder that you are a child of the 60s and a student at Berkeley, and I guess for that reason it almost has to be Bob Dylan, but why this song?
It does. I think, thinking about Proust, Bob Dylan is a kind of Madeleine for anyone of my generation. I think from Berkeley, the minute you hear his voice, you have a lot of memories. But this song in particular is a song he wrote actually relatively recently, and I think in 1997. So he was roughly about the age I am. And it's, I think, a fantastic song. Christopher Ricks, the professor of English literature, has written a whole chapter on this song in his book on Dylan, linking it to Keats' Ode to a Nightingale, almost line for line, and showing you how the rhymes are similar and how it isn't a coincidence. And then linking that Ode to a Nightingale back to Shakespeare's Sonnet 73. But one of the things which he talks about, which I feel very strongly about this song, is Freud said something like, every man needs, I think speaking about people at our age, to make friends with the necessity of their own dying. You can't go into it feeling anxious, or you have to kind of tame it. Maybe the Bessie Jones is about that in a way, too. But you have to kind of have a relationship to death. And it's, to me, Dylan is doing that in this song. He is trying to have a particular relationship to death and dying.
Shadows are falling, and I've been here all day. It's too hot to sleep, and time is running away. Feel like my soul has turned into steel. I've still got the scars, not the sun and nail. There's not even room enough to be anywhere. It's not dark yet, but it's getting there. And my sense of humanity has gone down the drain. behind every beautiful thing, there's been some kind of pain. She wrote me a letter, and she wrote it so kind. She put down in writing what was in her mind. I just don't see why I should even care. It's not dark yet, but it's getting there. And I've been to London, and I've been to Gamery. I followed the river, and I got to the sea. I've been down on the bottom of a world full of lies. I ain't looking for nothing in anyone's eyes. Sometimes my burden is more than I can bear. It's not dark yet,
are quite extraordinary, aren't they?
They are amazing. I think that line too, it's not dark yet, but it's getting there, the sense of imminence. Dylan's fantastic at that. If you think of the early songs, A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, I'm Going, Going, Gone, and All Along the Watchtower, you had this two horsemen were approaching and the winds began to howl, the sense that something's going to happen very soon. But here he's talking about, I think, his own death and about that and a kind of, as I said, trying to make peace with it. I find that very poignant, the trying to come to terms with it.
Bob Dylan, Not Dark Yet, from his 1997 CD, Time Out of Mind. I wonder, Stephen, having now almost got to the end of the programme, whether you feel that in talking about music, in listening to music and discussing what it is that we love about it or don't love, you do actually reveal things about yourself.
I've over this hour, I've come to think that I have revealed myself, Michael. Things that you picked up, the yearning quality in the music, some of the themes in them, the kind of acceptance of death and dying, the way in which music can recall memory, too. Yeah, I think it's been like an analytic session in that way.
Without a bill.
Without a bill. All you have to do is say, that's all we have time for today.
Your last music takes us back to your American childhood again.
Yes, I mean, this last piece just stirs up memories of growing up in the Midwest. To me, it's Chicago early in the morning. It's that time when people who work at night are going home and the commuters are coming in but haven't got there. It's the way that Chicago can look, the kind of canyons of those modern, the Mies van der Rohe and the Sullivan buildings. It's that. It's Edward Hopper paintings. It's the uninhabited cityscape. When I hear this music, I just see Chicago early in the morning.
And that scene that you set, particularly Hopper, and indeed here, Copland, this is not the bombastic Copland of Fanfare for the Common Man.
Right.
This is the elliptical, the nuances of a landscape.
I feel that there's something about the space of the sound.
Exactly.
Where it feels very open. There's something... It feels to me the space between big buildings in a city and then going out to the Great Plains. That's what I see when I hear this.
Stephen Gross, thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.